Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the Local News Roundup.
It's time to unclog the arteries of our region.
And with that, transit tax proponents ask for your vote and launch a Yes for MEC campaign. Hurricane Erin packs a punch on the North Carolina coast without making landfall and comes at a time when the state is still struggling to pay for Hurricane Helene. A second Mecklenburg County Sheriff's deputy resigns, echoing the concerns of another deputy who resigned over what they claim is bad conduct by Sheriff Gary McFadden. And Charlotte FC wins its sixth straight MLS game, remaining the hottest team in the league. And here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE climate reporter Zach Turner. He's here along with Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. And Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Morning.
The General Assembly said yes. The governor said yes. Mecklenburg County commissioners said yes. And now boosters of the referendum for the 1 cent sales tax for transit want you to say yes.
So forgive the medical analogy. It's time to unclog the arteries of our region and keep it moving. So, and we do that by saying yes to transportation, saying yes to better health, saying yes to economic mobility, saying yes for MEC. So thank you.
That's Advocate Health CEO Gene Woods speaking at an event launching a campaign mounted by the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance. Though we have been following the ins and outs of getting our transit plan to the voters and to this referendum in November, there are a lot of voters who have not been following this and have not a lot of detail about what it entails and what the referendum will actually say on the November ballot. So will this be a tough slog for supporters, Mary?
Potentially, yeah. I think education, like you said, is going to be the biggest thing for the Yes campaign and probably the No campaign too, really getting the public to understand this very complex plan and its implications both for our transportation system and what people will be paying when they go out to stores in the area.
Speaking of paying, the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance says it plans to spend between $3 and $3.5 million on a campaign to convince voters to say yes in an election for which the turnout for the general election is like 15%. Are voters who turn out, Joe, for these off-year elections the more informed voters, the one who really like to go to the polls and vote because it's their civic responsibility and therefore they will know more than maybe other people who just show up and go, oh, what's this?
Yes, I think that these are the, they're not casuals, the people who will be casting a ballot this November. I think the real Politico super fans are the ones voting in the Charlotte City Council primary that's happening right now. That turnout's like 20,000 people citywide. And then this November will be a little more than that, maybe 120,000. But I think that is certainly a more educated electorate that participates in off-year elections for Charlotte City Council. Still, though, they need to learn what exactly this plan is. I think that, you got $3 million. You should spend quite a lot of that making sure people know what's at stake if they vote yes or no.
So I guess the question that maybe nobody on this panel can answer is, if you are an educated voter with skin in the game and you really come out to vote because you like to vote, and those are the people that vote in these off-year elections, are you more prone to say yes or no to this referendum?
I don't know, because, there are a lot of educated voters, former elected officials who fall on opposite sides of this. So it depends what sources you're reading and who you trust and what you want Charlotte to be the next 30 years.
So, Ryan, I'm sorry, Mary, go ahead.
Just piggybacking off of what Joe was saying, I think, a great sort of example of what he was saying is the fact that you have not just former and current elected officials falling on different sides on this, but there's not a clear like party division. You've got more progressive Democrats like Braxton Winston very strongly opposing this. You've got prominent Republicans like Larry Shaheen and Ed Drake really supporting it. At the same time, you've also got people on both sides who have a lot of questions or have just straight up come out and say that they're not in favor. So yeah, it's not as clear cut as some other issues that we see.
And I believe I'm right in saying that former mayor Jennifer Roberts is against it, while the current mayor is a major proponent of this. Ryan, if voters say yes, the sales tax rate would increase to 8.25% on most things, but not everything. But still, it is a regressive tax because everybody pays the tax at the same rate. So what will not increase under this sales tax if we say yes? Do you know?
That is not something I have off the top of my head. Mary, okay. I think Mary's got it.
Yeah, Mary has her finger up.
Lifeline there, Ryan. Yeah, okay. So most food items are exempt. So for example, if you go to the grocery store and are buying a loaf of bread, some milk for the week, you won't pay sales tax on that. You would pay sales tax on prepared food. So if you get, you know, a sandwich from the deli or a cake for a birthday party at the bakery, that would be considered something taxable. And if memory serves, most medications are also exempt from sales tax. So some essential items like that, but you still pay it on things like clothes. If you need to get a new TV or a new laptop, you pay sales tax on things like that. The city has estimated that it'll cost the average Mecklenburg resident about $240 more a year, but a lot of that really depends on an individual's spending patterns.
And that's before tariffs. Last week, we talked about the opposition to this tax from civil rights leader Reverend William Barber, who led the Moral Monday movement.
This will be the fourth tax in 2 years. School bond, county property tax. And we're not necessarily against tax. We're against constantly being taxed in ways that hurt the poor and working poor, while the wealthy and the greedy never pay their fair share. The Bible says that usury is sin. Charging people interest and wrongful tax is sin, because it most often hurts the poorest.
And he's not alone. As you mentioned, Mary, several other prominent people have also come out against this tax. But Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles, who has worked for years to get this done, insisted this week, Ryan, that the plan can boost low-income residents. How so?
Well, they're saying that this will help with transportation. They really focused on Wednesday's event on bus transportation. They didn't really discuss light rail very much, getting folks to work, accessibility, things like that. It's also the issue, also boosting microtransit, which is their sort of new project that they're trying to get out to the public very often, which is sort of like city-funded Ubers, things like that. Stuff that will help people get to the grocery store, help people get to jobs, things like that. It's also sort of a point of contention among the opposition, though, however, just in the sense that they don't feel represented on which of these projects, how much will be funded on this newly appointed board that will make those sort of decisions.
Yeah, you picked up on something that WFAE's political reporter Steve Harrison picked up on with regard to this meeting. Most of the speakers, he said, tended to downplay the rail portion of this plan when they were pushing the yes vote. 40% of the money raised by this sales tax will go to rail for the Red Line and the Silver Line, which will now run allegedly from Bojangles Coliseum to I-485 past the airport. And Steve says that the Red Line commuter train to Lake Norman only had a brief mention in this. Is that, Joe, a good strategy?
I don't hold that against them, because there's so much. We've talked about the Red Line so much, and there are tons of different aspects to this plan. Most people who rely on public transportation in Charlotte are bus riders, and the bus is a very important part of this plan. And I think it is important that we focus a lot of time on the bus improvements, that because they'll be first and hopefully will be the most effective should this tax pass.
Yeah, because it takes a while to build rail, Ryan.
There's also the, I didn't even mention the roads are their other big push on Wednesday, right? Because that's sort of what gets Republicans on board, and their roads first mottos, things like that. So that's speaking to sort of the more rightward supporters.
WSOC-TV spoke with a gentleman named Juan Contreras Juarez, a transit rider who attended that kickoff event as a supporter.
Charlotte's going to keep growing. There's no way that we're going to stop people from moving to Charlotte. And so the transit system that we have now is decent, but it's going to stay the same, but more people are moving in. So that doesn't add up for me.
So organizers of this campaign launch event promised to feature voices from across the community. So was Mr. Juarez there of his own volition, Joe, or did boosters ask him to come, or did he just show up?
He is a daily commuter on a bus, and he spoke at the press conference about why this tax would be important. And that what you just heard from him was him saying that if this doesn't happen, you know, the Alliance just put out a statistic at that press conference that 157 people are moving to Charlotte a day. The transit system's just going to stay the same. And so he said, you know, if this fails, there is no backup plan. You got, you know, most likely Raleigh will be annoyed and they'll be hesitant to restart discussions on a new plan. And you got to, you know, put your hope in more Democrats getting on board, like winning seats over the next couple of years. There's just a lot of uncertainty about what actually happens if we vote no.
Mary, it took a long time for us to get this thing on the referendum. It seemed to move at less than a snail's pace until it didn't. Suddenly it became the roadrunner. Just like that. It was through the legislature, through the governor, through the county. And now it's on the ballot. And there is no backup plan, as Joe just mentioned. Is that part of the strategy to say, look, if this doesn't happen, we're screwed forever? Or is it just bad planning?
I think on some level it could be a bit strategic. I think, you know, a phrase that I've heard from a lot of supporters is, you know, we can't let perfect get in the way of what's achievable. You know, sort of the message is, you know, everybody would maybe want to see something a little bit different across the political spectrum, but this was the best deal we can get. We're not going to be able to go back and get a quote unquote better deal at any point in the near future. And the problems are just too big for us to punt. So I think that's been a big part of the messaging, even, you know, as things were moving through the process in terms of getting local officials on board with something like this. But, you know, I think the message coming out from the campaign now that things are in the hands of the voters is going to vary greatly sort of based on what demographic is being targeted, right? People in North Mecklenburg that have been waiting for the Red Line forever are likely to hear a lot about the Red Line. People in South Charlotte that are really concerned about road congestion are probably going to hear a little bit more about road money. Folks in communities that tend to be more bus reliant are probably going to hear a lot more about better bus. So it really kind of depends on the audience that's being targeted.
Yeah, and what I hear, Joe, and I'll let you talk, Zach. I know you want to talk about this, but what I hear, Joe, is that television is not going to get a lot of this money because you can't micro-target like that on television commercials. You have to use social media.
You know, television doesn't typically get a lot of off-year election money. I don't know what the Alliance's strategy is to spend $3 to $3.5 million. If they need ideas, I'm sure television will be something they pursue. But, yeah. You know, definitely those targeted ads are going to be a big part of this. Mailers. I think they're going to have more events like this, maybe in different parts of the region, highlighting potential projects. You're going to hear from them a lot.
Zach, go ahead.
I was going to say that there's a little bit of a timing component too, from a climate perspective here. And this is something that was interesting to see, that there were some city council members, current city council members, that were a little bit ambivalent about whether or not they were going to vote in favor of this plan, because they all unanimously have voted to approve this updated climate plan with some new climate goals that rely more heavily on bringing down community-wide greenhouse gas emissions. And you can't do that without a more robust transportation system. Transportation is the number one source of greenhouse gas pollution in Charlotte.
So when we come back, the other big story of the week was Hurricane Erin, which threatened to pound the Outer Banks, at least, with 20-foot waves. We'll find out what actually transpired on our coastline from Hurricane Erin, and talk about the incredible expense all of this is costing, most of which is not coming from the feds, when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Zach Turner's with us. He's our climate reporter at WFAE News. Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Joe Bruno reports for WSSC-TV, Channel 9. And Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor for Queen City Nerve. Hurricane Erin has been the focus of weather news for over a week as it began its journey from off the coast of Africa, as most hurricanes do in the Atlantic. It grew into a monster storm in terms of size. At times, it was a Category 5 hurricane with winds of 160 miles an hour. And even though landfall was always doubtful and, in fact, did not occur, the outer bands touched the coastline, and North Carolina officials were taking no chances. They declared a state of emergency and ordered evacuation. Zach, did that prove to be necessary?
Yeah, I believe so, in terms of just we did see a lot of like neighborhood flooding going on in the Outer Banks. We saw a lot of overwash, and there's a lot of compromised transportation infrastructure. There were large parts of NC-12 that were closed, for example, making it incredibly difficult for folks to have evacuated later on the southern part of the Outer Banks. And so I think it was a smart move to try and get folks out of the Dare County and trying to get them. I know they opened up an emergency shelter in Warren County further in the center part of the state.
This was Ryan Ellis with the National Weather Service on Tuesday.
Right now, wave heights at some of the buoys have already increased to 8 to 10 feet. We expect that to continue to rise, and then we do expect some inundation of Highway 12, which could make it impassable for several days.
And in later in the week, they were predicting waves as high as 20 feet to hit the Outer Banks. Did that happen?
Yeah, it was looking like from all the local forecasts, we were seeing stuff that was like between 15 and 20 feet. I was seeing like wave heights of around 18 feet in parts of the Outer Banks. And like I said, you could see these videos, especially of like homes in this Tri-Village area where they've kind of become infamous for homes falling to the ocean in places like Redanthi. You could see that these the storm surge and the waves were lapping up against these structures that were already kind of stranded on the beach.
Did we lose any homes?
Not that I know of. There were two very precarious homes in this region that were very much in threat of tumbling over, but I don't think we lost any new homes. Again, this is an area that saw six homes, I think, last year that fell into the ocean.
North Carolina's Emergency Management Director, Will Ray, was particularly concerned about the amount of damage this storm might cause, as well as the length of recovery from it.
Numerous roadways will likely become impassable, especially on Highway 12, as the governor mentioned, and in communities on the barrier islands. This will be a longer duration event, with coastal flooding expected over several high tide cycles. We will see rain bands trailing Erin that will also impact the area, already saturated soils across the area.
So this storm began moving away from our coast yesterday afternoon. Damage, how would you characterize it?
That's going to be something we're going to see probably more of today. I know that Governor Stein is going to be visiting Dare County, and there was still some flooding going on around NC-12, so it's going to be a while before that road, the reopening, they said it might be closed through the weekend. It kind of remains to be seen, but this is something that's going to be ongoing while North Carolina is still in the process of recovering from two other large storms that have happened in the past year.
Erin is the first hurricane of this season, a season that lasts every year through December, and experts believe this will be an active hurricane season. Dr. Rick Ludich of the University of North Carolina College of Earth, Marine, and Environmental Sciences told WFAE News that it is now more important than ever for those who live away from the coast to pay attention to tropical storms, including hurricanes, because of the changing nature of these storms due to climate change. I know we've spoken about this before, Zach, how climate change is altering the impact of tropical storms and hurricanes. So give us a refresher course on how is that happening?
I think Hurricane Erin kind of gave us a little bit of a masterclass on this. We saw that it underwent this process whereby when a hurricane passes over an normally warm patch of the ocean, it'll rapidly intensify. Mm-hmm. In the case of Erin, we saw that early on, I think last Saturday, where it went from a Category 4 to a Category 5 in short order. This is also the same process that Helene underwent in the Gulf right before it hit landfall in Florida. So what this does is it essentially makes these hurricanes, it's incredibly hard to forecast their strength as they're about to make landfall. And we're just seeing these storms go from, you know, less intense to more intense very quickly. They're also able to hold more water as our atmosphere continues to warm, making it much wetter storms.
And because of that, and because we're having more frequent and longer storms, they're becoming incredibly expensive when they do damage. And at a press conference announcing the state of emergency in advance of Erin, Governor Josh Stein talked about that and the need for federal resources to combat the effects.
The scale of these storms are massive. $60 billion in Western North Carolina from Hurricane Helene. Those kind of resources don't exist in Western North Carolina to respond. Heck, our state two-year budget is $66 billion. So essentially, we would have to forego the entire two-year budget just to get Western North Carolina back to where it was before.
The Trump administration and Donald Trump campaigned, particularly in Western North Carolina, on saying, we will not forget you and we will take care of you. And you're the most important people in the world, essentially. He's cooled on FEMA, and his administration has been very slow, I understand, in providing money that he has promised for Hurricane Helene recovery from last September. They also seem to want to push responsibility for the preparation and recovery for disasters in general onto the states. So is the governor pointing out the obvious that our state, that no state can really afford this?
Yeah, I don't know that that's like, I don't think it's reasonable to think that a state would be able to have a budget that would come close to covering a $60 billion disaster. This has been an ongoing conversation between Stein and FEMA for the last almost a year now. But earlier this year, Stein wanted to extend FEMA's 100% match for debris removal and emergency operations another 6 months. But then the Trump administration, FEMA, has opted to reduce it to a 90% match. And in terms of projects that they're trying to get approved, they've been lagging a little bit. This month, we saw $96 million in projects for road repairs, chimney rock repairs, grid repairs, other types of recovery projects. We got those approved, but we're still waiting on another $100 million in projects that we've submitted to get approved.
Last November, Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Chief Deputy Kevin Canty resigned because of claims that he made that Sheriff Gary McFadden ran his office like a, quote, third world dictatorship and fostered a toxic work environment.
Beginning with my second week in that position, I began to notice certain behaviors from McFadden that were deeply troubling to me, such as being abusive, using abusive language towards executive staff.
That's former Deputy Chief Kevin Canty talking to WSOC-TV last year. This week, his replacement Chief Deputy Christopher Allen resigned for similar reasons, calling his tenure, quote, the worst year of my entire law enforcement career. Joe, what else did he allege?
So he didn't really mention specific incidents, but he referenced a lot of themes, a lot of familiar themes that we have heard about McFadden's leadership style. He said during his tenure at the agency, he's endured constant backstabbing, lies, disrespect, and fake narratives, all orchestrated by you in an attempt to assassinate my character. He accused McFadden of creating a third world dictatorship. And he said, there's no amount of money worth the mental and verbal abuse that you inflict upon your executive and command staff daily. So a lot of troubling allegations about the leadership of Sheriff Gary McFadden. And
Which just raises even more questions about what exactly is happening inside that jail.
In that letter, which has been published in many different places, you can see what he says, and he refers to the sheriff's narcissistic behavior and coercion. It strikes a lot of the same themes that Kevin Canty did in his letter of resignation last year, which cited unprofessional leadership, abuse of power, the use of racially charged language, retaliation against those who challenge the sheriff, and more. And Allen, the new one to resign, Ryan, took another step in all of this. He accused the sheriff of using his office for personal gain. Was he any more specific than that?
I think it all has to do with, he does these events. He's got the SUVs that are wrapped with his face on them, and he goes around and he's been accused of using his position as a campaign tool regularly and to further his own agenda. I think promote your own agenda was actually written in the letter itself. He's been accused of targeting employees that he doesn't agree with or he doesn't feel like are totally on his side. It feels very sort of Trumpian in that sense, where he really just wants loyalists in his office. It's something we reported on in depth as early as January 2022. And was sort of brushed off by the sheriff's office at that time. But as you see, there's sort of been a line of folks coming after him that have confirmed that sort of thing, where it's just sort of he's looking for loyalists and he's not going to put up with anybody who has any sort of different point of view within the department.
So Kevin Canty resigned last September, and now we have Christopher Allen resigning for similar reasons. Were last September's allegations levied by Mr. Canty, Joe, ever investigated, and will these allegations be investigated?
If they were investigated, I'm not aware of it happening. I don't believe they have. I'm not sure what the actual impact is of submitting something like this, other than letting people know that there's very clearly a problem going on right now. The sheriff responded to this letter by basically saying, I want to assure everyone that the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office is fine. Between this, there are tons and tons of controversies now. It is clear that there are some serious issues right now that need to be probed.
Well, we had Sheriff McFadden on this program somewhere in the interim between these two resignations, and we talked a bit about this, and he had reasonable explanations for some of the accusations. But these are just allegations. He's not guilty of anything yet. These are just allegations by employees who have resigned. Mary, you wanted to chime in here?
Yeah, just talking about the potential consequences of these allegations, I think it's worth noting that the sheriff has already picked up, I believe, at least two challengers for his next reelection campaign. So this is a publicly elected official, so you could see consequences at the ballot box, even if there isn't a formal investigation.
And I know you want to talk about that, Joe, but I have a question about that. Maybe you can answer this and roll it into your diatribe here. The sheriff is an elected office. Does the holder of that office report to anyone? Can he be disciplined by anyone? Can he be dismissed by anyone? Or is that entirely up to voters at the ballot box?
He is held accountable by the voters. I think maybe if he commits a felony, then we can, you can talk about there might be, he might have to step down, but it also might be might have to be convicted of the felony. But his position is mainly held accountable by the voters. The county might have some oversight where, since they, provide funding to the sheriff's office, they might be able to say, hey, we need to bring in a third party investigator to probe what's going on there. Maybe the Sheriff's Association, the North Carolina Sheriff's Association, could do something similar. But ultimately, it will be up to the voters to decide who they want to be sheriff. Sheriff McFadden has not said if he is running for reelection.
Okay. Last week, when Montrevious King dropped out of the race for the Charlotte City Council District 3 seat, he threw his support to incumbent Tijuana Brown, saying that the Black Political Caucus had its finger on the pulse of District 3. That may or may not be true, but this week, the Black Political Caucus threw its support to another of Brown's challengers, Joy Mayo. She won that endorsement by one vote, 46-45. Mary, how important is that to the outcome of this election?
It could be significant. You know, the Black Political Caucus endorsement is not a guarantee of victory. They don't have a perfect batting average, but they have a pretty good one. It is one of the more influential endorsements, especially amongst sort of the higher propensity voters that you're going to see turning out in a very low turnout primary election.
And Tijuana Brown and her daughters are under federal indictment for allegedly fraudulently receiving $124,000 in COVID-era relief loans. She has pleaded not guilty. Did this indictment play any role in the Black Political Caucus's endorsement, Ryan?
I think it probably did. I'm not on the inside by any means, but I'm sure that when you have a caucus vote coming down to one specific vote, then you almost have to guarantee that had that indictment not existed, she would have been endorsed. Again, I can't speak to all the voters, but that just has to be a thing. Joy Mayo has been a strong community advocate for that area, so that's not to take anything away from her, but it could not. I mean, one vote is, of course, the indictment must have played in somebody's mind state while they're making that vote.
And last week, we talked about how Tijuana Brown was questioning the result of the Black Political Caucus vote. She was alleging that not everyone who was eligible to vote got an opportunity to vote. And she told WSOC-TV, Joe, that at her request, they were addressing her challenges. The BPC denied those charges, issued a statement on Saturday saying the process was carried out in a fair and transparent manner, ensuring accuracy and integrity in tabulation. But did it investigate her charges?
I think we can give the BPC the benefit of the doubt that they at least looked at what Brown was alleging. And it's clear the decision they made was opposed to what she was requesting. I also don't fault Brown for, you know, fighting for that one vote. I think if we all lost by one vote, we also would pursue any avenues we could to see if we could make that one vote up. But the BPC stands by the integrity of the endorsement process.
Clearly, she was disappointed in the outcome of that endorsement. But has she said anything about the final endorsement? Has she, now that the thing has been investigated allegedly and they're standing by Joy Mayo, their choice, has she said anything about that?
She hasn't said anything, but I know Councilmember Brown, I bet she's thinking she doesn't need it. So, like, she knows the people of District 3. She grew up in this district. These people know her. She knows them. She's out at the polls right now in the rain. I don't think she is sweating too much about not getting this endorsement.
So the Black Political Caucus endorsed Dante Anderson in District 1, Malcolm Graham in District 2, Joy Mayo in District 3, Renee Johnson in District 4, Marjorie Molina in District 5, Kimberly Owens in District 6. All are Democrats, and all except for Joy Mayo and Kimberly Owens are incumbents. The District 6 seat is currently held by Edwin Peacock, who is now running for city council at large. They made no endorsement in District 7, and no Democrat is challenging Republican Ed Driggs. Anybody have anything to say about that in the 20 seconds we have left?
Iron Man Ed Driggs, he hasn't faced a challenger since 2017. Whatever he's doing in District 7 is working, but not enough for the Black Political Caucus endorsement.
And we're talking about this now because early voting started yesterday in the primaries. We come back, we'll talk a little bit about that and about a kerfuffle at a Carla Cunningham town hall. Stay with us.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Aiming to inspire high school students through an international curriculum and IB diploma program, preparing them for college, careers, and a global community. More at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Zach Turner is here. He's our climate reporter for WFAE News. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Ryan Pitkin is the co-editor, the editor and co-founder of Queen City Nerve. And Mary Ramsey is a local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. I mentioned that early voting began yesterday for the September primary in this off-year election. Mary, if only 15% of voters are expected to vote in November, how many are expected to vote in early voting or even in this primary?
Probably not exactly a groundswell. Yesterday was the first day. Early voting starts with just one site at the Hal Marshall Annex. We'll get some more sites across the city opening up in the coming days. So usually, you know, you see kind of a surge on day one. and things drop off, then a little bit of a pickup at the end of early voting ahead of actual primary election day. So I don't think we'll exactly see any lines wrapping around city blocks, but certainly, you know, a nice opportunity for folks during early voting. You can register and vote at the same place. You can also vote at any of the sites, not just your designated polling place. So some added convenience there for folks that want it.
Joe.
That surge of voters on the first day of voting, Mary was referring to 157 people cast a ballot yesterday, which is up from 2023 when 131 people cast a ballot on the first day. If you're curious how many of those votes were for the Republican primary of District 2, because, you know, there wasn't a Republican primary in 2023, two votes were cast yesterday in the Republican District 6 primary. Let me just say, more people were in the Sprouts grocery store line an hour before the store opened this morning in Noda than voted yesterday.
I just want to point out that the winner of these primaries, they pretty much will win their seats on city council. So this is the important election, not really the one in November, except for the fact that the referendum on transit will be on the November ballot. This is the important one, correct?
You're exactly right. District 3, 2023, 3,000 people voted. You know, District 3 is the most closely watched primary this year. Will more than 3,000 people decide the fate there? We'll see.
Ryan?
I think District 6 also will be the only one that gets watched in the general election this year. It'll probably be a close Democratic.
For people who don't know, that's Tariq Bakari's old seat that is currently temporarily being held by Edwin Peacock, who's not running for that seat. He's running for at-large. And Republican Sari Chakra and Krista Bakari, Tariq Bakari's wife, are duking it out in that district. Who has the better chance there, Ryan?
Oh, I think the name recognition goes to Krista Bakari for sure. She's already got the endorsements of most of the local Republicans. I wouldn't be shocked if she runs away with the primary, but it'll be a close race in November, I'm sure.
Okay, voting is underway. Republicans around the country, when they have been holding town halls, which is rare these days, are getting an earful from constituents who are not happy with national policies being instituted and supported by the GOP and the Trump administration. And this week, some of that dissatisfaction trickled down to the local level and to a Democrat who recently crossed the aisle in the legislature to give Republicans enough votes to override Governor Josh Stein's veto of a bill that now requires sheriffs to work closer with immigration and customs enforcement. Here's a selection of comments that Carla Cunningham made on the floor of the House before she crossed the aisle and voted with Republicans, giving them their supermajority.
It is time for my unapologetic truth to be shared with all of you. All cultures are not equal. We have been exploited and abused by the different tactics to gain citizenship in America. It's time to wake up.
She added that it was time for immigrants to assimilate and stated that as an African-American descendant of slaves, she would not take a back seat to those destabilizing our communities.
So today, if you ask me to line up behind another group of people to raise awareness about their plight, I unapologetically say no.
Those words were still ringing in the ears of her constituents on Sunday night, Ryan, at her town hall. What did those folks have to say?
Well, folks basically just wanted to come out to see if she stands behind them. And if you've been watching her Facebook feed, you know, we just heard her say unapologetically twice, and she has stuck to that completely. People just wanted to know whether she regrets the stance of all cultures are not created equal. And for better or worse, she does not. She does not regret that statement. And, you know, she was yelled down a couple of times. She threatened to shut down the town hall. There's about 100 people there, and it was very negative out for her in terms of the folks who were there. It's been a constant bad look for her since that speech was given. You know, she has doubled down a few times.
We have an example of when she was asked at least once by an audience member whether she would change anything about how she voted or how she delivered her message, and this was the response.
No, I wouldn't change a thing about it. I am being authentic. I am being authentic. I am speaking my truth. And I am also elected.
Someone also asked Cunningham if she still considered herself to be aligned with the Democratic Party, and she responded, quote, "I don't consider myself aligned with any party. I consider myself as a person that looks at the information I am given and sees if it's beneficial to my community and then makes a decision." She is known as a moderate to conservative Democrat who has voted with Republicans on other issues in the past. So is this attitude something new, or were voters aware of this approach when they elected her? I guess that's the question.
I don't think it's anything new. You know, as you mentioned, she's known as a moderate. She's done this in the past. I think the real uproar came because of that speech. She could have made that vote. It might have been she would have gotten some social media flack for a few days and people would have moved on the news cycle. But she gave a speech that sounded like Stephen Miller wrote it, and folks have really stuck onto that. Like, they're not going to turn back, it sounds like now. But, any post she makes on social media now is nothing but comments about how ashamed they are of what she had said. That being said, she's still a very strong candidate, a strong representative in Northeast Charlotte. She's done a lot for her constituents, and that's sort of the point she tried to make at her town hall. So she's not guaranteed to be voted out for this, but you know, some of the things that have happened now, Democrats are still very sore from Trisha Cotham, and it's just folks are really starting to see reflections of that and concern with if she's even going to stick around.
Yeah.
Donald
Trump was elected in large part to bring down inflation. He promised multiple times on the campaign trail to do just that. He also promised that we would love the tariffs he intended to levy on other countries and that they would be great because those other countries would pay those tariffs. Of course, that's not true. American businesses pay those tariffs and eventually pass those rising costs on to us. And that's just starting to happen. Inflation is not getting better. It is rising as a result of these tariffs. But former North Carolina House Speaker Republican Tim Moore, now a member of Congress, says whatever short-term pain there is from these tariffs, quote, it's worth it to break an American addiction to cheap labor and cheap goods. Mary, has there been any reaction to that comment? Because I got to tell you, I like Timu.
Yeah, so the North Carolina Democratic Party did put out a statement in response to Congressman Moore's comments on inflation, basically saying that these short-term pains he was referencing are higher costs for North Carolinians. Former Speaker Moore, you know, sort of towed the party line, really emphasized the Trump administration's belief that increased tariffs will lead to increased American manufacturing in the long term because businesses will move production back to the U.S. He used the example of an iPhone, saying that folks should be willing to pay a little bit more for an iPhone made by an American worker in order to support American jobs.
Do Americans who buy iPhones and anything else for that matter care where it comes from? Are they not shocked? Isn't that the whole reason that Target and Best Buy and Costco and Sam's Club exist? Because you want to get the cheapest price for the best goods you can possibly find. Do they care if it's made in America?
I think the average person is going to be more concerned with the cost, given the tight budgets many Americans are operating on these days. There are certainly, particularly in communities that have been hard hit by the death of American manufacturing jobs, that may be more interested in, like former Speaker Moore said, paying more for an American-made good. But that being said, I think, you know, the average person is probably more concerned in an economy like this with just what they're going to be paying at.
So I'm curious about the political efficacy of this. I mean, you have the Secretary of the Treasury saying something similar to that. Donald Trump has also said something similar, referring to having little girls get $2 instead of $50 at Christmas time or something like that. And the U.S. Producer Price Index, which tracks inflation before it hits consumers, reported its biggest jump in more than 3 years this month. That means more inflation is headed our way just in time for Christmas shopping. So are comments like Tim Moore's simply tone deaf, or are they illustrative of someone being hell-bent on supporting the policies of an increasingly unpopular president?
I think his comments were generally in line with the Trump administration's beliefs and sort of the current GOP party line. I think Democrats are likely to pounce on that messaging as we look ahead to 2026 and 2028. As I mentioned, the North Carolina Democratic Party had already put out a statement about the producer price index numbers and put out an additional statement specifically about Congressman Moore's comments. So, you know, that was a rich area for Republicans in 2024. I think Democrats are hoping it'll be a rich area for them in 2026 and 2028, but at least for now, the party line is still lockstep with the Trump administration.
Yeah, and I have four words that seem to ring true in everybody's ears. It's the economy, stupid. And I said he's an increasingly unpopular president only because all of the polls, the Pew Research polls and others, show that there is an increasing downward trend in his popularity on all these traditional markers. Another firing of a county manager. Cabarrus County Commissioners on Monday voted 3-2 to fire Sean Newton. Commissioner Lynn Hsu made the motion, saying the firing was with cause. Joe, what cause? Why?
We don't know the cause. We are told there's a cause. We know this guy's been on the job for 4 months, maybe five, depends which way you're around. There's a lot of different politics at play here. It goes back to a couple months ago when this county manager was hired, Sean Newton. He was the business partner of the outgoing chairman, Chris Meesmer. Meesmer got appointed then to the state Senate. And then through a bunch of other drama we won't get into, we have a new chairman, and now this new chairman kind of serves as referee with the two different factions of commissioners, all of them Republicans. And he sided with the two other commissioners to oust this county manager.
And Lynn Hsu made this attempt back in March when he was first appointed to get him out, and she failed. Is this just a continuation of that effort, or has he done something?
They say they have cause. The chairman put out a statement saying that they are not creating chaos for no purpose, essentially. So whatever that something is, it has not been disclosed to us. The other two commissioners who were opposed to this say this caught them off guard, this motion.
It was the mysterious firing of his predecessor. Well, his predecessor was mysteriously fired as well. I guess to put it that way, Mike.
Yeah, there was a little. At least that was hooked to something. We know that the commissioners who fired the predecessor were upset with. They thought that they overpaid for the former ACN building that everybody sees on 77 and the conversion of it. So that was like the start of that firing. They fired him for that. They said it was for cause. Now there's a lawsuit that is ongoing because of that firing.
The Mecklenburg County Health Department has issued an urgent public health advisory to the public, Ryan. What is this about?
So this is sort of a continuation of an ongoing issue I reported on last year where there's a rise in syphilis rates countrywide, statewide, Mecklenburg County. It sort of gets more severe as you localize it in this case. But the new warning is due to the fact of congenital syphilis, which is coinciding with that rise in cases with also a nationwide shortage of the medication that's used to treat the disease, which is Bacillin LA. So Mecklenburg County Public Health is just asking that any pregnant women or women planning to get pregnant in the future be aware of this rise, talk to their doctors about it. And then they're also telling healthcare providers to please contact the health department if they're having trouble finding said medication. Health department can help them do that rather than just sort of give up on it and tell their patients that they can't get any.
The P.T. Barnum of NASCAR, Humpy Wheeler, passed away this week. He had a 33-year career in racing and was responsible for transforming the sport and the Charlotte Motor Speedway during his tenure as president of that track. He spoke just last year at the NASCAR Hall of Fame when he received the Landmark Award for outstanding contributions to the sport.
Well, that's what makes racing is people that step up and say, hey, we're going to have some fun this afternoon or tonight. And that's what I wanted to do.
Humpy Wheeler was on this program several times. A great storyteller, just a fun guy to be around. He died on Wednesday at the age of 86. And finally this morning, Charlotte FC is said to be the hottest team in Major League Soccer. It won its sixth straight MLS match on Saturday night against Real Salt Lake. We started strong. The team started this strong this season and then kind of fell apart midseason. And now it's operating on all cylinders, to use a NASCAR reference. How has Coach Dean Smith turned things around, Ryan?
I would say it has to do with our home strength. They've won 10 matches at Bank of America Stadium. That's a club record, or at least tying the club record. I'm not exactly sure on the pronunciation. Aidan Taklamadi is as hot as they come right now. He's got, I believe, 6 in his last 9 MLS matches he's scored. So we've tied club records for wins and wins at home. 14 wins going into, 6-7 matches left, I believe.
Seven matches,
pretty strong little playoff picture. So the team, like you said, has really picked it back up.
And the next game is Sunday night against the New York Red Bulls. Any handicap on that game, do you know?
I just know that we have a piece on our website as why you should hate the New York Red Bulls more than any other team in MLS. So go check that out.
And that website would be queencitynerve.com. That's Ryan Pitkin, co-founder, editor there. Mary Ramsey's local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Joe Bruno reports for WSOC TV Channel 9. And Zach Turner is our climate reporter at WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.